2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 322, Madame Ridiculous and Lady Sublime, Up Close and Personal. Participant, Eloise M. Bell.
This is Session 322, Madame Ridiculous and Lady Sublime, Up Close and Personal. For those of you who were looking for something else, now would be a good time to check your schedules and get to the appropriate rooms. I say that because we've actually had some trouble. There's some spacing issues on this thing. My wife, the smartest woman I've ever met, a Harvard graduated master's, blah, 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 thought that her session, which is in Cascade 2, was here, you see, because the word Cascade 1 is right next to that title. So we just want you to know what you're getting right up front. So, as per usual, the admittance to this session is by tag or ticket only. I know there is nobody taking or checking here, but, you know, God knows if you paid, so, you know, deal with your reward in heaven or whatever. And also, make sure your cell phones are off, just as a courtesy, if not to Eloise, to me. Just because it annoys, and if for some reason it's on and it goes up, give us a show. Pretend like you're a doctor or something. You know, explain what, a life I must save, and run out the door, and then we'll go, oh, that was all right that the cell phone was on. So there's that. But on to our session. I spent 4 years at BYU and never had a class with Eloise Bell, which is probably why I thought my experience there just sucked. So. I think a dose of Eloise would have done me some good there. And only last night have I finally come in contact with her sense of whimsy, and I'm very excited for that. She is a professor emeritus at BYU, writer, beachcomber, and her email address is in here if you wish to begin a correspondence. And, well, now that that's over, Eloise Bell.
Thank you. Is this essential for the recording or just for the sound?
It's essential for the recording. If you put it on your lapel,
yeah,
it'll pick up everything.
Okay.
The wonders of the, you know.
Rarely in my history have I needed a microphone for the sound, but we'll bow to the electronics. Yes, I'm going to sit and read to you. I'm not going to stand on any remiantum or anything else. Thank you for being here. Thank you for this opportunity. My friend Carolyn Pearson always starts her presentations with a joke. This hasn't been my style, but since Carolyn's not here, I'll start. Come on in. Two bishops met on an airplane high in the sky. One was a Catholic bishop, one was a Mormon bishop. They didn't know each other. But they were being friendly and exchanging little pleasantries. And at one point, the Catholic bishop turned to the Mormon bishop and said, do the Mormons still say not to drink coffee? Is this still something that is observed? And the Mormon bishop said, oh, yes, this is still part of our word of wisdom that we don't drink coffee and tea and so forth. And the Catholic said, if you don't mind my asking, have you ever been tempted? Have you ever tasted coffee? And the woman said, yes. You know, some years ago, I was curious about this, and I had some coffee. And the Catholic nodded understandingly and went back to his magazine. After a while, the woman turned to him and said, speaking of those things, does the Catholic Church still require celibacy of its priests? And he said, yes, we still take that vow of celibacy. The Mormon said, have you ever been tempted in that respect? And the Catholic said, yes, many years ago when I was a young priest, I was tempted and I did succumb. The Mormon nodded and said, a lot better than coffee, isn't it? I think Sunstone must be a lot better than coffee, although I'm not sure about whether it's better than sex, but certainly better than coffee, and I'm glad to be here, and I appreciate your coming. So I thought I would read a little bit and read a couple of pieces, and then if you had a question or two, we could take a question or two, or a comment, or a jeer, or whatever you feel like doing, and then I'll read some more, you know, kind of a format of that sort, if that's all right with you. So, let's start out with a question I have had posed to me a number of times. Why retire? I retired from BYU in 1994, when I was 59. That's a bit early, and I taught two more years for the honors program part-time, and then fully retired in 1996. Why retire? When my turn came up on the university rumor roulette wheel, colleagues stopped me in the hall to ask me if it was true that I planned to retire soon, and if so, why? Others sidled into my office and got down to much brassier tacks about early retirement, especially the financial details. In particular, some wondered aloud how one knows that it's time to move on. In response to this last query, you know that it's time to retire when? When more and more frequently you have the feeling that you've read this very same student essay or faculty memo before, many times before. Students were doing recycling long before it became popular. More and more colleagues whom you consider to be junior faculty, very junior faculty, begin to sport receding hairlines and bifocals. More and more you find yourself unable to read the fine print on anything, including the class schedule. This shortcoming can result in you showing up the first day of a semester before a class of startled engineering technology students instead of the familiar-looking gaggle of English majors who are even now in a classroom across campus waiting for you to not appear so they can leave. More and more of the university's administrative councils are former students of yours. What this means is that the people who write the memos requesting that you discourage headscarves and excessive creativity in student haircuts are the same individuals who not that long ago wrote you inflamed freshman essays satirizing the no sandals without socks protocol. However, do not make the mistake of reminding these administrative personnel of the irony, or they may remind you that our friendly institution in Xi'an, China, is looking for exchange faculty. More and more students report that their mothers or fathers had you, as they so charmingly put it, for freshman English. Later, you discover that the student is the youngest of 11 children and that his father is a grandfather several times over. A resentful grandfather, you discover around the holidays when they come to visit, who has never quite forgotten the D-plus you gave him all those years ago before grade inflation hardened all of us into the commission of routine perjury. More and more, when returning alumni ask you the inevitable question, are you still teaching English? Their tone is no longer rhetorical. What else would you be doing? But amazed, you are still here? You have the feeling they're planning to fax a bulletin off to the Guinness Book of World Records as soon as your aching back is turned. More and more you find that you do not know the current names for anything. The steno pool is no longer the steno pool. The secretaries resent being called secretaries. The audiovisual services are gone from the campus directory. And the direction you most often get from the directory is C, as in, see some other name for this. Got a problem with keys? See Portal Security Implementation Technology. And what do the names mean? Risk management. You know what that is? That's the fire marshal. Productivity and Quality Research Group. This is not functioning out of the dairy farm, however it might sound. Distributed Systems Support Group. What's that? Is it a 12-step group? Are they working on recovery? Where do they stand on Prozac? Do they hug after each meeting? Distributed Systems Support Group. What about the Imaging Center? Is this in the advertising department? Is it a hangout for public relations majors? a mirrored salon in clothing and textiles? Are we talking about photography? Philosophy? What? I don't know. But, says the university newsletter, it's really no problem. We'll teach you. I've been invited to go to classes on Windows, also classes on faxing, on email, on the library's gateway, on BitNet or NetByte, and the Internet. Does anyone remember the notorious classes dealing with phone mail? I am not making this up. We went to classes to learn how to operate the phone mail. Yesterday, I entered my sanctuary and found that in my absence and without my knowledge, my permission, or a kiss my key, my office chair had been removed and replaced by a state-of-the-art chair. Dangling from the arm of this wonder was the 16-page booklet of instructions on how to use the chair, how to adjust the arms, the back, the seat, the angle, the height, and what to do during liftoff. I am currently sitting on an upended wastebasket while I try to find my glasses in order to read the wretched instructions printed in English, Japanese, Chinese, Korean, and Klingon, and learn how to operate this gizzy-wiz. So file this away for future reference. When your office furniture is more sophisticated than you are, it's time to retire. Now, speaking of retirement and asking questions, at dinner last night at the tribute to Albert Peck, I was rather startled when somebody asked me a question. They asked, and very politely, said, now, if you don't want to answer this, please feel free, but was your retirement hastened by the university, or were you encouraged to retire early? I was rather startled, but I realize that people probably have been asking this since I retired about 6 years before most people usually do. So I want to use this occasion, I suppose, to answer that question. Retiring early from BYU was entirely my choice. I found out that I was able to do it financially, and I wanted to do it so that I could travel before my knees filed an ultimatum, so that I could go up and down the metro, the Montmartre metro in Paris, if you've been down that huge, long staircase and some other things like that. So I retired for my own reasons. Second point is this is rather amazing, but no one from BYU or from the church has ever hassled me about anything I have said, written, or done. I take that back. Somebody did once hassle me very briefly, but the person was not associated with the academic powers that be or the church. One of my colleagues, I was teaching a creative writing class, poetry writing class, and a colleague of mine who also taught poetry writing and actually thought that was his turf, that I was really invading his turf. But he happened, I guess he was checking on things and found that the text we were using was a good anthology of poetry that happened to be called Naked Poetry. That was the metaphoric title of the book. Well, that raised his concern, his red flags. And then he happened to find on page 328 that there was a poem which had the word C-U-N-T in it. So he went to the department chair. Instead of coming to me and saying, are you using this book? Which was a perfectly fine book. He went to the department chair and filed a complaint. The department chair, who was the wonderful Richard Craycroft, the delightful Richard Craycroft, he came to my office and said that Professor so-and-so had this concern. And I looked at him and I said, Richard, you have your exalted position exactly for the purpose of feeling such nonsense. Now go back and tell him to get a life and don't bother me anymore about this. That is the only hassling I have ever had on a subject. I wasn't even hassled when I took off my skirts for good. I have to explain this just a little bit. For a very long time, BYU had a policy that women, well, first of all, not even women students were allowed to wear slacks or Levi's. That was the old days. Then the students won their rights to wear their own clothes, but the faculty women were not to wear slacks or pantsuits, heaven forbid, Levi's, anything like that. You just had to wear skirts. Even though people complained about this. But what the complaints couldn't do, the gas wars and the oil shortage did achieve, because remember, some of you will remember in the 70s we had to lower our thermostats because there was a fuel shortage, and a lot of people who couldn't care any less about feminist issues of clothing were freezing their fannies off. And so they went to the administration and said, we need to wear pants during the cold weather. So a decree went forth across the campus saying that from October 1st to April 1st, women could wear pants. I call it the studded snow tire rule. Exactly like the studded snow tire. And when April 1st came, there would be little notices in the bulletin saying, now, sisters, it's time to take off your slacks and pants and put back skirts. I have to confess now, openly, before God and you, that I never looked back and I never put skirts on again. After that, we were given that inch, I took all the yards I could get, and I never again wore a skirt or a dress at BYU. And nobody ever said anything to me about it. Now, they might have said things to each other, you know, that kind of thing, but then nobody ever said anything to me. And in fact, I never thought about that. You know, the question is understandable. The person who asked me last night about whether I had been encouraged to leave or asked to leave, it's an understandable question, because there are faculty members in my own department who were asked to leave, who were encouraged. Some of them were simply told not to come back. All of that happened pretty much after I retired. There was one case of that before I retired. So the question is understandable. I didn't fault the person for believing that faith-promoting rumor that apparently has circulated. And in fact, there are times when I feel a little bad, because I feel a bit like Emerson. When he went to visit Thoreau, Thoreau was in jail for having done some civil disobedience against a tax law that he felt was unjust, and he was arrested. Henry David Thoreau was arrested and spent a couple of nights in jail. And Emerson came to visit him and said, Henry, what are you doing in there? And, of course, Thoreau said, Ralph, what are you doing out there? In other words, why aren't you in here with me protesting? And in answer to the question, why wasn't I hassled, I have no answer. I don't know. But in the interest of justice and fairness, I want to go on record as saying I have never been hassled by BYU or by the church. Rumors to the contrary. Okay. Any questions from you about mostly about the reading or the writing or anything? Anybody want to say anything there? Mary Bradford.
Did you make quite a statement about feminism, defining it?
Yes, in fact, I gave the very first speech ever given on the BYU campus about feminism. I gave it in a wheelchair. Just a few weeks prior to that, I had gone down a fire pole and broken both ankles. And I was in a wheelchair, and it was a marvelous occasion. It was in the Marriott Center, and this was so early that nobody was afraid of the specter of feminism. It was 1975, and yeah, I gave a talk on feminism, and nobody was rattled then. Of course, you know, had I done it 10 or 15 years later, it would have been very different. Mm-hmm. Okay, yes. I have never gotten hassled by Steve Samson.
Is that not a general BYU policy?
It is now. It is now. But it came out after I retired. I don't know. Go figure. Yes?
So what did they say specifically? Did they send out a memo and say, you as a professor can never speak at Samson?
No, this is sent out. It was sent out from in the general newsletter or whatever. And I don't know the specifics. You need to ask. But BYU faculty and staff are discouraged from participating in there's a certain word, some kind of symposia. Pardon?
Alternate forums,
perhaps something
unsponsored.
Something unsponsored, something like that. And I suppose that in private, people have been, people who were active speakers have been told they better not. Nobody ever told me anything like this. It came out in the bulletin, but this was after I had retired. So you need to check with somebody who's had more direct experience about it. Nobody's ever said anything to me about this. However, I do know that a very dear student of mine and a very talented man who was encouraged to apply for a position at BYU, teaching something he knew very well, came up and was interviewed, an eminently qualified person who is mainstream Mormon right down to the color of his shirts. He was not hired because he had, in fact, spoken at Sunstone and had won, I think, the D.K. Brown fiction contest a time or two. Anyway, that's what he understood, is that's what, why he was not hired, and BYU is the loser in that, obviously, in that exchange. Okay, now, not only did I retire in 1996 officially, but in 1999, I moved as far east as one can go without being afloat. I live now in South Carolina. People have asked me why I moved, and I said, look, For Moses, 40 years wandering in the desert was enough. I came to BYU, taught my first class at BYU in 1958. I taught in parts of five decades, the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And then I said, okay, I've wandered in the desert. Now I'm going to a part of the country I have never been before. But as I say, I'm very close to the water, very close to the Atlantic Ocean. And that prompts me to read to you an essay. This is from Madam Ridiculous and Lady Sublime, out on sale at your favorite book counter outside, and we'll be doing signings at noon if anybody should want an autograph or something of that sort. But this is called The Devil, You Say. Mormon doctrine teaches that Satan presides over the waters. For this reason, when I was a missionary, we were cautioned to avoid aquatic travel whenever possible and were not permitted to go swimming. Presumably, mission presidents had worked out some kind of render unto Caesar compromise with the Prince of Darkness. We'll stay away from your turf, you leave ours alone. On a personal level, I can't confirm Satan's dominion over the bounding main, but I can indeed testify that a nymph has repeatedly created mischief for me whenever I felt too comfortable upon the waters. And I have felt at home in the water since I was a guppy. My family spent many summer days at my grandfather's lakeside cottage. This was in the east, in the northeast. And my mother always packed at least three bathing suits for me, otherwise I'd be not out of one long enough for it to dry. By the time I could pack for myself, we had moved to another state and to a house 3 minutes from a lake, and I spent those years perpetually wrinkled, clean, and blissed out. Southern Arizona has little territory for the Prince of Tides to occupy. After we moved to Tucson, my adventures on water shriveled to an occasional Saturday swimming lesson in the resonant YWCA pool. The YWCA of those days was probably off limits to water imps or devils or demons. I remember it as a place of interesting Spanish architecture, cool tile floors, high ceilings, and an aura of purposeful, disciplined recreation. Impish antics would have had short shrift there. For the Y clearly belonged to Miss Dodge, who tolerated little nonsense and no mischief whatsoever. She governed by sheer personal presence, being 6 foot tall, prematurely white hair, with a thrilling contralto voice that could have parted the Red Sea. As long as Miss Dodge was in the building, I could have lain at the bottom of the pool for hours and been perfectly safe, emerging with nothing worse than wet braids. Or so I believed. Thus, when senior ditch day arrived, high school senior ditch day, I had been almost 6 years away from serious water. Our class, for its senior celebration, chose a recreational park in Phoenix. Among the activities was a canoe race around an artificial lagoon. Nancy Linderstrom and I paired up and leaped into our canoe, full of the confidence that blooms like mushrooms among high school seniors in May. The year was 1953, so of course none of the girls wore slacks or shorts. I myself was resplendent in what we innocently called a squaw dress. a two-piece affair with matching blouse and a full circle skirt. Mine was marine blue with yards of silver braid. I spread the skirt grandly over the canoe seat, and Nancy and I set forth with much vigor and zero technique. Vigor seemed to suffice in that contest, and we were soon ahead. Ahead of the other girls. Ahead of the boys. Wahoo! Our classmates lined the winding channels of the lagoon. Our senior English teacher, Mrs. Cooper, shouted encouragement, brushed back her straggling auburn locks, and puffed on a cigarette. Since we were not in school, she could smoke. In the front of the canoe, I was determined to make a memorable finish. I switched my paddle and dug deep on the left. But Nancy was already digging deep on the left. Thus, as our whole world watched, the canoe did a slow-motion tilt, and we slipped ever so gently into the waters, as undramatically as a leaf falling from a tree. My blue squaw skirt billowed up and spread wide upon the waters. I surely must have resembled a full-bosomed frog atop a great lily pad there in the calm lagoon. Even my exit lacked all drama because the channel was only 3 feet deep. So I simply slogged ashore, towing about 50 yards of wet skirt behind me like a tangle of barnacles. Mrs. Cooper suffered the most damage from the adventure. She was convulsed in a coughing fit. Face red, tears slip sliding down her makeup, henned hair totally awry, little screams escaping from her mouth when she could catch a breath. Frankly, she looked like the devil. Later, as a dutiful missionary, I never even took a cruise boat down the Seine during my tour of duty in France. The baptismal fonts were as near as I got to things aquatic. In most cities, we had portable fonts constructed of steel pipes and blue tarps, making up in practicality what they lacked in aesthetics. But the mission home in Paris had something elegant. The mission home, a four-story building in the fashionable 16th arrondissement, had once been the embassy of a small but stylish nation. Remodeled to suit the mission needs, the top and bottom floors were strictly utilitarian and plain, but the second and third floors had been left in their full rococo glitter. The mission president's wife always made a point of showing the guests Napoleon's bathroom, a lavish chamber of mirrors, marble, and gilt, the centerpiece of which was a magnificent tub, deep, deep tub, that only little Bonaparte's ego could have filled. With very minor remodeling, the deep tub became a baptismal font, and the Parisian converts could be baptized in a style to which they were sure rich Americans were accustomed, with mirrors on four walls, cheeky gold cherubs watching from the cornices, and the prayers resounding solemnly around the marble boite. On several occasions after the ceremonies, I spied members of a convert's family scooping little vials of water from the font. When we missionaries launched into sober preaching against the holy water approach, we were airily waved away. Only a souvenir, we were told. Only a memento. When my mission concluded and the traditional farewell testimony meeting had been recorded in mission history, I was issued a second-class ticket on the great Cunard steamship Queen Elizabeth. We did not then, of course, call her the QE1. She was D1, and there was no need for numbers. Apparently, the We Won't Go Near the Water Treaty applied only to active missionaries. Once released, you could sink or swim on your own. My traveling companion, Kent, was an elder released at the same time. No contrast could have been greater than the 5 days at sea, which followed my 25 and Kent's 30 months on the mission. We were waited on at table three times a day by a large and kindly British waiter. Someone made our beds each morning. We had absolutely nothing that we were required to do from dawn till dawn. We chose not to identify ourselves with other returning missionaries aboard. The white socks yawning beneath their frayed black trousers gave them away. And we slept 14 dreamless hours each night while the great Elizabeth rocked ever so slowly and comfortingly on the bosom of the deep. If the Prince of Darkness was in the vicinity, he had bigger fish to fry than we two.
Did you go swimming, though, after that?
After the mission, you bet. But not during the mission. Never during the mission. No? Other questions, comments? Okay.
Did you swim on the way home?
No, there wasn't the opportunity. And I didn't have a swimming suit. I don't know whether the Queen Elizabeth had a pool. She probably did.
Yeah.
I know she had movie theaters, and we went to the movies, but I didn't have a swimming suit. There was, you know, there was no way I did that. Last night, during the encomiums about Albert Peck and the whole occasion of the Sunstone experience, I believe it was Philip Barlow, talked about the ultimate purpose and reason for being for Sunstone was the continued quest for what it means to be human. And I thought that was very well put and very apt. And that prompts me to read an essay called The Quest to be Human from Madame Ridiculous here. Here's a riddle. A television series aimed at a mass audience has, among others, two male characters. R is tall, dark, and handsome, conventionally masculine, yet unconventionally sensitive and egalitarian. D, on the other hand, is neither tall nor handsome, but rather strange in appearance, cast in the nerd mold, and emotionless. Now, which of these two characters do you think would be most interesting? One would think so, but that's not the case. On the reruns of Star Trek The Next Generation, Commander Will Riker fits every standard for mass media heroes. He is brave and forthright, frequently giving a forceful tug to his uniform to prove his readiness for action and maybe just to keep the blasted tunic from riding up on his maddening midriff. Lieutenant Commander Data, by contrast, is an android, a machine, who looks like a human being except for a chalk-white face. He is a supercomputer, able to perform all sorts of computations with blazing speed, able to listen to and understand seven pieces of music at once, able to duplicate on the violin the exact style of play of any great violinist, etc. He is programmed to be completely free of any human emotion, fear, anger, anxiety, love, you name it. And yet Data is the most interesting and engrossing character of the whole rather large cast. Now, what's the key to that riddle? Aristotle claimed that a person is his or her desire. You are your desire. Janet Burroway, in her book Writing Fiction, A Guide to Narrative Craft, tells her reader that a character to be interesting must want, and want intensely. Well, Commander Data wants, and what he wants is to be human, or as human as possible. Therein lies his attraction as a character. Now, I've puzzled over whether wanting or desiring is itself an emotion, and thereby a plot inconsistency as far as Data is concerned. On the other hand, his desire could be driven by curiosity, a function of the mind, rather than of the heart. For the sake of argument, let's accept the android's desire as a given. If you haven't seen much of Star Trek, you may wonder at my wasting time in a discussion of a science fiction serial. Actually, over the months and years, the program focused less and less on the intergalactic skirmishes, the high-tech hardware, and the bizarre life forms, and more on rather complex psychological and societal issues. Data is a case in point. His positronic skills were dazzling, but as time went by, they were featured less and less. Data became, in fact, a vehicle for exploring one of the species' most intriguing questions: what does it mean to be human? Commercial mass media production or not, the exploration on The Next Generation was thoughtful and artistic. Various episodes focused on Data confronting the conundrum of human nature. In one story, he tries to conduct a romance by the book. Worried because a young lieutenant, a good friend, has broken off her involvement with another officer and is sad as a result, Data courts her with the hope of lifting her spirits and also of discovering what human courtship is like. He does everything right. Flowers, gifts, compliments, candlelight dinner, music. And predictably, he ends up without a sweetheart. Very nearly without a friendship as well. In the closing frame, he sits in his room with his cat. On his face, an expression that is neither depressed, nor sad, nor regretful, or even lonely. Just blank. Intelligent, but emotionally empty. In another episode, Data explores humor learns to tell jokes, even conjures up a holographic audience, an audience that looks real but is not real, for his stand-up comedy routine. But an audience programmed to laugh is even less satisfactory than a laugh track. I have to tell you a footnote here about programmed laughter. This took place a number of years ago, but one of the general authorities, well known for telling good stories and humorous stories, was being sent to Japan to talk to the saints there, and he was a little bit concerned because he had so many jokes, and he knew that these didn't always translate very well. So he didn't know how this was going to work. But he was assured that the elder who was translating was wonderful at the job. Not to worry, just go ahead with your talk, it'll be fine, Elder so-and-so. So he got up before the Japanese saints with the elder by his side translating, and sure enough, laugh after laugh after laugh after laugh, just went beautifully. Afterward, the general authority was talking to somebody else and said, well, you know, that did go pretty well. I guess the laughs translated pretty well. And the person who he's talking to said, well, to be candid, sir, when your talk began, the elder explained in Japanese to the saints that you would be telling a number of jokes, and since they didn't translate, he would let them know, and at each point they were to laugh. And so as the joke came up, he would say, Elder so-and-so is now telling a joke! Ha, 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 ha! An audience programmed to laugh is even less satisfactory than a laugh track. When Riker tries to comfort Data by saying that humor is not the most important thing about being human, Data replies, yes, but it seems to be the quality most uniquely human. Oh, do I love that. Humor seems to be the quality most uniquely human. This character is interesting, in other words, because he is busily and intelligently engaged in a quest nearly all of us pursue, whether consciously or otherwise, the quest to become more fully human. By way of footnote, it's interesting to compare Data with Mr. Spock from the original Star Trek series. Spock was half Vulcan, another species, and half human, the Vulcan tradition being one that scorned emotion, indeed feeling no emotion, but valuing logic and reason exclusively. Spock favored his Vulcan heritage and had no interest in becoming human. He was satisfied with what he was. And for that reason, I submit that he was a far less interesting character than Data, who is not satisfied. And before any of you whip out your phasers, Trekkies, let me make clear that I deeply respect Leonard Nimoy, who acted the part of Spock. I just think he deserved a fuller role. Let's introduce another character into our musings. Stevens the butler from the book and film Remains of the Day. You've seen Remains of the Day, read the book, some of you? A rich book, an opulent book, about an emotionally impoverished man. As I interpret the book, it raises the same question. What does it mean to be human? Stevens and Data are alike in many ways. Stevens is an almost superhuman butler, the automaton in a tuxedo. He works diligently to efface any personal emotion. Like Data, Stevens worries about humor. For the new master of Darlington Hall is given to bantering with his butler, who initially is at a loss about how to respond, but who at the book's end is making plans to study bantering so that he may better serve his employer. We cannot believe he will be any more successful at studying jokes than Data. But unlike Data, Stevens is striving to become less. His idea is to efface himself as a person. He observes that his earlier employer, Lord Darlington, claimed that he was more truly alone when Stevens was in the room than otherwise. He was more alone when Stevens was there. Stevens literally loses himself in service. In fact, he creates for himself a cocoon, a gilded retreat from which he does not emerge into the larger world. He mentions proudly, not grudgingly, how rarely he leaves the mansion itself, even to stroll on the grounds. What is of greatest interest for Stevens is dignity. He sees that quality as the essence of is the essence of truly great butlers. And how does he define dignity? In essence, is the absence of emotion, except when one is totally alone. How successful he has been at separating his emotion from the rest of himself is shown in the scene treating his father's death. Stevens is serving at a major function downstairs, and he allows himself only the briefest moment to visit his dying father upstairs. Back downstairs, Stevens goes on serving, and only the concerned questions of others bring him to realize that he is crying. He is so out of touch with his own emotion. Being fully human seems to require full consciousness, and the word conscious implies knowing with. To be conscious is to share knowledge of oneself with another, and with oneself, capital S. So Stephen's goal, to let down only when he was totally alone, spells a dead end. With that limitation, his capacity for growth is barricaded. Perfection, or at least order and dignity, without risk, without pain, without emotions, without loss. Or loss, tears, pain, mistakes, sacrifice of dignity in exchange for something less than perfection. Maybe, as often happens, the answer can be found in the folds of a paradox, that something less turns out to be something more. That people, misguided and weak as they are, can emerge heroic because they are trying to push the boundaries, and that Stevens, unwilling to make the soul journey at all, has sold his soul for a mess of polished silver. Okay. Questions, comments? Addenda. I think we have time for one more, perhaps. Yeah. And I will read the title article, Madam Ridiculous and Lady Sublime. One of the ongoing mysteries of life is the thin line. You know, the thin line that separates laughter and tears, or the thin line that slices between love and hate. My favorite appearance of the thin line in its perennial is its perennial presence between the ridiculous and the sublime. For sheer drama, fun, suspense, will the sublime teeter over into the ridiculous this time? Nothing beats opera, and the grander, the better. I grew up among committed Philistines who thought that all opera was funny, period. For one thing, the operas we heard in my childhood years were sung in foreign languages, and everyone knew that foreign languages were a hoot, an abnormality, like a man walking upside down on his hands or crawling instead of walking upright. After that, the conventions of this particular art form, a man singing for 20 minutes after he's been mortally wounded, for example, or a woman the age, size, and general consistency of grandmother performing the delicate Madam Butterfly, and you have an idea of my family's general perspective. My father actually found a certain mild amusement in listening to operatic numbers from time to time, never entire operas, of course. He particularly enjoyed moments when the full backfield line, as it were, grabbed the ball and headed downfield in a razzle-dazzle exhibition. When four, but sometimes six, and occasionally even eight singers got going on a number, as happens in Faust, the Barber of Seville, Cenerentola, my father envisioned the quartet as an athletic contest of some kind, with basso and baritone, mezzo and coloratore, each doing their damnedest to sing faster, louder, and more tragically than the other. Or, as Dad saw it, to beat the other guy to the finish line. He was always surprised that they ended up on the same note. As a small kid, I took his metaphors quite literally, and I used to giggle at the imagined picture, when we heard this on radio or on records, the imagined picture of, say, hefty Lawrence Melchior and even more rotund Zinka Milanoff race-walking down some great stage. Melchior in a penguin suit and Madame Milanoff hoisting the skirts of her glorious heavy gown, described in detail by Milton Cross for the radio audience, in order to move faster, the entire ensemble singing their wretched hearts out as they lumbered along. The picture certainly appeared to my sense of the ridiculous. Years were to pass before I stepped across that thin line and tasted of the sublime. As sometimes happens, the sublime crept over the line rather quietly, without any drama. As a 12-year-old babysitter, I found myself several times sitting in the ordinary small house of a very unordinary young couple, a transplanted New York professor of English and his witty wife. Their little house had the same four rooms, the same eight windows, and the same dusty backyard as every other house on Glen Street. But in other respects, it might as well have been Shangri-La. Besides the books that lined every wall, and I didn't know that private citizens could own that many books or actually write in them, as Professor Taub obviously had done, they had a phonograph. No, not a hi-fi, and certainly not a stereo. And they had record albums. Greg's Piano Concerto in A. I memorized them. Saying their names was like reciting poetry. Carmen Jones. I knew that the lyrics and the storyline in this modern version of Carmen had been changed, but the music was the same as the scraps I had heard before. The stirring Toreador's March. Of course, my brothers had other words to sing with the tune about not spitting on the floor, but in the cuspidor, etc. The beautiful love ballads, the pulse-raising drinking song. While little David Taub slept, I soaked up a whole art form, an entire realm of experience into my thirsty Arizona skin. As sophomores in college, my dormmates and I periodically put on black skirts, white blouses, and little white gloves, and earned $2 an evening ushering at concerts for the university's artist series. And one evening, Carmen came to town. If I'm not careful, as I revisited the occasion in memory, I see the glorious Risa Stevens as Carmen, with her wide, ironic mouth and flashing eyes teasing the bullfighter, the audience, life, me. But of course, it wasn't Risa Stevens. Not in Tucson, not then. I knew Stevens, Carmen, from movies only, but that was enough. She'd been present for me in every production of the opera that I've ever seen. At least three photographs of me exist in which I grasp a rose in my teeth. That's pure plagiarism from the superb Mrs. Stevens as Carmen. I have no recollection of how events led to my next experience with opera. I just have a clear picture of myself standing on a chair in someone's living room, a 22-year-old graduate student in a bedsheet. Swanson aluminum pie pans pressed into service as breastplates, unbent wire coat hangers representing lightning bolts, yo-ho, to-ho! Wagner's peculiar blend of the ridiculous and the sublime had grasped me by the throat, and all through grad school I did party stints as Brunhilde. I never again gained the proper reverence for Wagner, especially after seeing the wondrous comic singer Anna Russell do her 20-minute version of The Ring Cycle. Many operatic experiences followed, none grander than those in Paris, seeing Faust while I was a Mormon missionary, speaking of the thin line. But the choicest mingling of ridiculous and sublime came in Salt Lake City at the splendid Capitol Theater. A friend and I had decked ourselves out as best we could for the grand occasion, but I must say that our best was pretty paltry. Country Mouse would be putting it mildly, Mormon Dowdy would be more exact. When we slipped into our seats, our fears were confirmed. The rest of the audience glittered and gleamed, while we could have been walking advertisements for the bargains available at Deseret Industries, sensible shoes and all. And wouldn't you know, the two women who edged into the seats next to ours were especially resplendent, one in black silk hostess pants, elaborate hairdo and power earrings, one in a brown velvet cocktail dress set off by a dramatic coral feather boa that I coveted fiercely. I slid down on my spine and tried to lose myself in the program notes. Then my friend whispered that the newcomers were, in fact, not women. I thought she had lost both oars. But no, she was right. The stunning beauties beside us were not sisters. The shapely, perfectly manicured hands were large and hairy. The elegant heels were size 14. And the voices were not even tenor, but vibrant baritone. I sulked right through the overture. I mean, when you're shown up that badly. By someone who only does female fashion as a hobby. A weekend diversion. You know just how ridiculous you are. But never mind, the opera was sublime. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Over to you, Matt.
Where were you when I needed you, Eloise?
I was there. You were roaming around campus doing heavens knows what.
Screwing around writing for student review. All right, well, thank